Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Good. Well, we're back with Choral Chihuahua, and four of us this week after Eamon's really interesting episode last time, and he'll be very much back again, which with, I think, an epoch-breaking episode next time, which we can look forward to. I'm here with my colleague, Sir Nicholas Mulroy.
Good day to you.
I'm imagining that the knighthood will be the next thing on the list.
Only a matter of time, isn't it?
Yes. And two mystery guests, who you will announce very shortly, but I think we should hear the jingle. So, Sammy, say the words.
Welcome to Choral Chihuahua.
Unexpected cadence in bagging area.
That's so good, isn't it? And from our massive post bag of hundreds of... We really don't. Correspond, you lot. Come on, give us something to boast about, our massive podcast bag. People write in to say, so what was that cadence from? Well, that was Carlo Gesualdo in a piece called Merce Grido Piangendo, which is a stupid title. Like most of his poetry, it's just a few sort of gasps and grunts. It has no poetic worth at all, but great for composers. So yeah, Priacchio Moro, Before I Die. Mystery guest number one, actually in the US, as we're going to be talking about choirs from the USA today, which is something I don't know very much about. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Christiana Howell. I am currently living in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, but I'm from Eugene, Oregon, originally, which is the complete opposite side, the western part of the country. I'm currently getting a doctorate in choral conducting. I have too many degrees I keep getting, it's hard to keep track. And I had the pleasure of getting my master's degree in choral studies at the University of Cambridge. So it's nice to sort of come full circle.
And you've come to us through Sarah McDonald.
That's right.
Who we were talking to recently. And our other guest is a former student of mine, but many more things before that, Luthien Brackett.
Hello. I'm now living in London, and as you mentioned, I was a student in Robert's MA in solo voice ensemble singing at the University of York from 2018 to 2019. Before that, I lived in New York City for about 8 years, where I was a professional choral alto and mezzo-soprano soloist, and I'm now doing that same job in the UK.
Now, we've got lots of things to talk about today: schools, church, community, differences to the UK. I hope that listeners are going to leave this program with some sense of an idea of the American choral scene. And I hope it might just knock us off our post a little bit, or get us to think about that, because I think there's just a little bit of we lead the world in this. And, you know, we do lead the world maybe in little bits of it, but I think what we hope to get from today's programme is an alternative perspective and a realisation there are other ways of doing things and other ways that thousands of choral singers in the US are approaching this. And that's without even necessarily covering many of the choral types that there are. We're going to start with something that you've described, Christiana, as the Midwest American Lutheran College sound. Tell us what you mean.
Right. Well, and I have to make a disclaimer that I'm relatively new to the Midwest, having just moved here in 2020. But it's just a massive tradition of choral music here. Probably the three main colleges that are the most well-known would be St. Olaf College, Concordia College, and Luther College. And those are all in Minnesota and just have these wonderful choral traditions, all Lutheran colleges. And the Lutheran Church is probably the most prevalent here in Minnesota. And I guess it's got roots that are based in Church of England and certainly some of the same traditions, the same format. But it's become this just entrenched tradition here in Minnesota, where we also have the National Lutheran Choir, which a lot of members come from those three colleges and others. There are tons of Lutheran colleges here. And part of that sound, I think, was developed by people like F. Melius Christiansen and others who just really cultivated this love of music, this love of singing. It could maybe be equated to sort of the cathedral chorister tradition in the UK, where people are brought up from a young age singing and singing a lot. So I know like St. Olaf, for example, I think rehearses for over an hour every single day, Monday through Friday. They memorize all their music, and I'm sure we'll talk about this.
I was just going to ask what you think, before we hear it, perhaps, what do you think of the main characteristics of this stuff?
Oh, man, and I'm sure not an expert on this, as I didn't come from this tradition, but now it's become sort of this more full-bodied singing, lots of different colors in the sound. I know Concordia College specifically has sort of evolved from what began as a purer tone, more of a straight tone, which I know is a bad word to say in choral land.
It depends entirely where you're standing, doesn't it? Because we could be having another program and say that vibrato is a dirty word. We'll get into all this. Anyway, let's hear it. This is Beautiful Savior by someone you've already mentioned, F. Melius Christiansen in St. Olaf College.
Thank you.
So many questions about that. The thing I'm going to say at the start is just, I hear sincerity. Have I just posted that onto it? But I really, really hear intent. And Sammy and I are very interested in intent in singing. Let's not get bogged down right at the start. Let's talk about some things we said we were going to talk about. Christiana, can you start us off talking about school, which, as we're very exercised at the moment in the UK with the lack of school opportunities for singing, as well as the available ones, how important that is?
Right. I think that is one thing the US does well is we've got elementary schools, you know, like primary schools, middle schools, and high schools that all have choral singing as part of the curriculum. So in the lower grades, the younger years, there's usually some sort of general music in almost any school, unless it's quite underfunded. But most of these public schools I'm talking about have some sort of introduction to music. Sometimes it includes learning notation, playing instruments, movement, lots of things like that. As they get into middle school, they usually have a choice whether they want to participate in band, orchestra, or choir. And choir tends to be the one that is the biggest because it has the least amount of barriers in terms of, you know, purchasing an instrument, taking private lessons. So from the beginning, there does tend to be quite a large choral music scene in the public schools.
We should just, we're going to be divided by this common language today. We should straight away say that public schools means state schools.
It exactly. Doesn't mean
what public schools means in this country. And the other thing, you're talking about actual curriculum time. We're not talking about hymn practice on a Monday, which everyone tries to bunk off. You're talking exactly. about dedicated teaching time.
Right. Yep. And then in the high school, there are usually multiple ensembles. So several auditioned choirs, several non-auditioned choirs, often gender-based choirs or voice type-based choirs, being soprano, alto choir or tenor bass choir. So it's a quite rich tradition that then doesn't always maintain after that. I think, you know, in the UK, you've got these cathedral schools where kids are learning music at a very young age to a very high level. So I think the difference here is that the music making is taught a lot more by rote, you know, a lot more call and response, less notation based. So then at the university level, we have a total mix in our choirs of people who read music very well and people who don't read music at all, which with both are legitimate. And we try to address all of those.
And straight away, I can just think of, well, two things there. Firstly, let's just underline what the number of people involved in cathedral choirs is incredibly small. It's incredibly important, but it's an incredibly small number. That doesn't replicate doing music in the schools. And Tom Leach from Leeds Cathedral was talking about his outreach program recently and how it's basically... Actually, he didn't want to use the word outreach. He was trying to say it's about music in schools and the fact that a few people can sing in the minster is kind of neither here, in the cathedral is neither here nor there. Luthien, what was your experience of growing up singing?
I was also very fortunate. I went to state schools exclusively and had access to a wide range of musical educational opportunities from elementary school. So in elementary school, I did a little bit of playing cello. I also sang in the school choir. When I got to middle school or secondary school, I did get to a point where I had to choose between choir and orchestra. So I chose choir. When I got to high school, I had even more opportunities. I went to a very large high school with a huge number of choirs. I sang in a treble choir and then a mixed voice concert choir and also a show choir, which is a choir that dances as well as sings. And that was really good fun. And I also was able to take elective music theory in high school. So I had a really good background in sight reading and theory by the time I went to conservatoire as a university student. I was able to take private singing lessons. And, you know, it's access to music education does vary. As Christiana said, there usually is a good foundation, even in state schools, but it's probably worth mentioning that in America, each state sort of directs its own state-run education system, in addition to which state schools are funded by something called property taxes. So the value of your home sort of determines what the property taxes are that you pay. And so therefore, there's more funding for state schools in affluent areas. And I was fortunate that I grew up in Northern Virginia, which is essentially a suburb of Washington, D.C. Lots of government employees, lots of, you know, high property taxes, high value properties, lots of funding for things like music and other, you know, arts pursuits in state schools.
And in both of your experience, in terms of when people arrive at university, is there a sense that different students come from different places? Do you have a different musical identity if you're from, say, California than you have if you're from, say, Virginia? Or is it more integrated nationally? What's the kind of, how does that work?
I think, like you said, Luthien, it's much more dependent on the area within that state that they grew up. So there might be a high school that has five auditioned choirs because the property taxes are high, because, you know, people have voted in legislators that care about the arts and appropriate that much funding to the arts. So I'd say within California, or none at all, right? Within California, you have a vast difference from high income to low income areas, just as it is in every other state. But there are particular states like Minnesota, for example, that just have such a rich choral tradition and so many choirs. It's unbelievable that area does tend to be a little richer in terms of choral background.
Now, so far, this is all about school. Where does church fit into this, Luthien?
That's an interesting question. So many of these states where you have these huge choral traditions, as Christiana mentioned, that comes from the sort of religious settlers of that area. So the Lutherans in the Midwest, the Moravians in central Pennsylvania, things like that. I didn't attend church when I was in school. Interestingly, I did there are a number of different sort of competitions you can participate in depending on where you are in the United States. When I was going to school, there was kind of all regional choirs. There would be county choir, regional choir, and then all state choir. And I remember auditioning for one of those choirs, and my feedback, you would get written feedback from the judges. And one of them said, oh, you should really join a church choir. And it was something that I hadn't even considered. But this is something that is, you know, obviously hugely important in America. Society is becoming more secular in general, certainly as it is everywhere. But the religious tradition in America is a huge, you know, has a huge influence on choral singing in particular and just music making in general in the community across the United States.
I think, too, the diversity of denominations within the Christian church is massive, you know, so we've got Baptist, Methodist, Episcopalian / Anglican, which we won't get into that. You know, so many denominations that have such different choral traditions. And so I grew up in an Episcopal church as a chorister singing, you know, Church of England, basically copy and paste Church of England music. And, you know, we did evensong and things like that. And I think those are few and far between compared to more evangelical or contemporary, I call them movie screen churches, you know, big church with theater seats and screens is becoming more the norm now. And that style of music is much more contemporary, much more pop based. So there's just a huge spread across the board in terms of style.
And we should say at this point that if you're listening in the US and thinking, but they haven't talked about my type of choir, that's going to happen today. We cannot possibly cover everything. But let's have another piece of music. Christiana, tell us about this.
So this is a spiritual by Moses Hogan, who is one of our most beloved American treasures. He was an African-American composer, arranger, who sort of elevated this style of music, the spiritual, that African American spiritual that came out of slavery and came out of work songs. And many composers, Undine Smith Moore is another one, sort of took this beautiful, beautiful just singing style and transformed it into something we might label as more classical. And so it sort of took the spiritual and made it art music. And a lot of American choirs and choirs all over the world just love performing this style of music. And maybe we'll talk about this more, but I think it's so important that we do these songs. And I think a lot of choir directors shy away from them, you know, because they don't feel like they're adequately educated on the background, or they don't have the choir demographic that represents the demographic that would have sung these. But it's so important that we keep this tradition alive and keep this music alive. So this is a wonderful recording of the Atlanta Master Chorale, one of our most well-known and most excellent groups based in Atlanta, Georgia.
Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord by Moses Hogan. And you can look it up, and we encourage you to look it up on YouTube, that one. Because the thing that really hit me is not just the conductor is only conducting at the moments he absolutely needs to, which I think says a lot. But the choir is so physically free. It's also just relating to the fact that, you know, it doesn't have the demographic of a choir who would have sung spirituals back in the 19th century. And they all seem so free in it. I suppose we could, you know, we could get into that whole sort of discussion. But mostly I just thought it was interesting that you said that everyone should be singing these songs. What terrific arrangement it was. And the whole tightness of us who've stuck in choir stalls for many years compared to the physical freeness. It wasn't that they were dancing. It was just that they were physically free and they were doing it all in their own way. So I do encourage people to go and look that up on YouTube.
It seemed to me, Christiana, to have sort of the best of both worlds that Robert's implying there is that there's incredible discipline, and the tuning is excellent. The actual vocal, individual and therefore collective vocal delivery is very free and very resonant, say. but also there's this real freedom and embodiment to the sound and to the performance that's incredibly accomplished, right?
Yeah, I think they're all connected. I think that freedom of movement and full body singing makes the intonation better and makes the balance better. It's like this magical thing that happens, which we're all striving for in our choirs, but is really hard to build in unless you do it from the start during warm-ups and, you know, just constantly having whatever silly gestures you have them do. But just feeling so comfortable in their own body, I think, is so good for choirs.
Can we move on a bit both now to university? There's obviously a great range of stuff. I mean, I know a little bit about what happens there through people like Gabriel Crouch at Princeton and perhaps David Hill. But those are English people doing your jobs effectively. So can you tell us a little bit about the provision for choral singing at universities in America and where the strengths and weaknesses lie there?
Well, I was fortunate in that I attended a conservatoire called Westminster Choir College, which is in Princeton, New Jersey. That's where I did my undergraduate degree. And unfortunately, Westminster is sort of fighting for its life right now, but that's a story for another time. What's really wonderful about that conservatoire and unusual, especially at that time, which was the 1990s, is that every single student enrolled at Westminster sang in one of the school choirs, regardless of what their principal instrument was. And it was a small environment. I mean, my high school graduating class was over 500 people, and there were barely that number of total student and faculty at Westminster. So it was a very sort of intimate experience. And it was wonderful for me because I particularly loved ensemble singing and knew that that's what I wanted my focus to be. But at that time in the United States, if you were at a high level of musical performance and you wanted to study at a prestigious school, like say Juilliard, for example, it was expected that you would go into opera, that was the pathway to professional singing. There was not at that time an understanding that it was possible to have a career as an ensemble singer or that it should be something that one should study, ensemble singing, close harmony singing. That is changing, I'm happy to say. And over the past several decades, we have started to see some programs at universities focusing specifically on the skills that are needed to become a professional ensemble singer. Programs such as the one at UCLA, Seraphic Fire is a professional choral ensemble based in Miami. They have a professional choral institute in Aspen during the summers. There's the Yale ISM, Institute of Sacred Music, which is a completely subsidized program, so the students there pay no tuition. And there's the...
Don't tell anyone about that one, please. It conflicts with mine.
And, right, exactly. Yeah, it conflicts with yours. And then, of course, there's the VOCES 8 U.S. Scholars Program. So there are more and more being added all the time that specifically address the skills needed to be a professional ensemble singer as opposed to a solo singer, an opera singer, or a solo artist.
And that does reflect a little bit here, doesn't it, Sammy, in that conservatoires are still training people to become solo singers. That's what conservatoires have always done. It's the same in Europe. And it's still not seen as a sort of first choice. I remember when I first started working with Claire Wilkinson, she wanted to do top quality ensemble work, and that was her achievement. And at the time, someone might have regarded her as not very adventurous for that, whereas for her, it was absolutely the music that she wanted to do.
It's a strange one, isn't it? The criteria for success for a conservatoire singer, I think in the UK, let's say, perhaps it's changing, but certainly in my time, it was always, you know, you were supposed to be the guy at the front of the opera stage. And obviously, even statistically, that's not really terribly realistic. And also isn't for everyone. It's not for everyone vocally. It's not for everyone in terms of musical personality. It's not for everyone in terms of, you know, artistic fulfillment. So it's great to see things like your solo voice ensemble singing M.A. Robert at York, which is excellent, obviously, and better than all the competitors. But yeah, it's great to see it changing because firstly, it's an absolutely legitimate career pathway. I mean, when I started, effectively, Ifagirini was my kind of training ground where I learned to sing vocal chamber music, really.
You could have paid us £10,000 a year. I hadn't thought about it that way around. That would be a great idea.
The cost was much greater to my own person, though.
No, we talked about the sort of official side, schools, churches, education, but I'm just wondering whether most people's experience of choirs is in the community. Of course, that includes church. But Christiana, tell us a bit about what there is there.
Sure. Yeah, I direct a community choir called the South Metro Chorale, which is in the South Metro of Minneapolis. And it's amazing to see the range of just different types of people. We've got some 21, 22-year-olds up to people in their 80s. And I think people that have come out of these university programs, then looking for what's next. You know, maybe they have jobs that are not in music, but they just long to have that singing experience because it feeds their soul and they love the community of it. So community choirs in this area are huge. I mean, I'm sure there are hundreds in Minnesota.
Hundreds in Minnesota.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And Minnesota has the nickname, since every state has a nickname, the land of 10,000 lakes. But many people refer to it also as the land of 10,000 choirs. I don't know if there are quite that many, but I'm absolutely positive that it's at least 1,000 in Minnesota. Just within the Twin Cities, there are over 100. So,
but that surely goes back to the fact that they all did it at school.
I think so. And then, you know, you graduate, you still want that in your life. So most of the people in my community choir are in at least one other choir, and many of them are in several choirs. Some of these people are retired, which I think sounds like a great way to spend retirement, just going to choir rehearsals every day. But there's a huge range, too, from choirs like mine that we do masterworks, but we also do a lot of smaller things and mostly secular, some sacred. And then you've got like the National Lutheran Choir that does sacred music and to a really high degree. And each one sort of has its own characteristic and its own flavor. So I think it's such a wonderful thing that, like you said, is totally a product of the school and the church system, people just wanting to sing more.
Let's go to the other end of the scale for our next track. This is a piece that's quite well known about here. Well, I say quite well known about. I don't think there are many UK groups that have actually done this. This is part of Caroline Shaw's Partita for Eight Voices, the piece that won the Pulitzer Award. And Caroline Shaw, we're getting to know at the moment because of one particular piece, which is And the Swallow, which is a beautiful thing. I mean, lots of choirs are doing that now. But we played a piece of hers in the last episode, which was to do with the Tempest text, the jangling sounds, which I really liked. This is an older piece, but it's fascinating, Luthien, isn't it? This is your choice.
I love this piece. And Caroline's music, I think, is absolutely magical. This came off of their first Grammy-winning album. They've just won a second Grammy this past February. And the thing to know about Roomful of Teeth is that, as far as I'm aware, what they're doing is entirely unique, certainly in the United States, but maybe abroad as well, in that they really focus on, first of all, they do, as I understand it, very intensive residencies with composers, working very closely and intimately with composers who then create pieces especially for them. And secondly, they really focus a great deal on alternative vocalizations. So not traditional singing that we're familiar with from the Western classical tradition. Things like Tuvan throat singing, yodeling, that sort of thing. So you get a huge variety of colors and sounds that can be produced by the human voice.
Say that first word again. Tuvan throat?
Tuvan throat singing.
It's something that I think started with monks, where it's a state of relaxation and meditation. And what you do is you get your false vocal cords to vibrate. So you're simultaneously vibrating your vocal cords, and then you hear these overtones. So you're creating two pitches at once. I can't do it. But I know people that can. It's pretty cool.
I think my dog is currently trying to do it, so we should quickly move into the track itself.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you.
That was the second movement, I believe, Saraband, from Partita for Eight Voices, which is Caroline Shaw's Pulitzer Prize winning piece for Room Full of Teeth.
It's good to have a little look at that online again, because you can see them doing it. And the I think there are things that they do with their voices that singers from sort of Fagnini background and others wouldn't know how to do and still be healthy. You know, it's really interesting.
It's a super cool piece, isn't it? It's right at the top of my list for programming wishes. We've actually got a new Caroline Shaw commission coming for Dunedin's Song of Songs program, which we're doing next month in May. I can't tell you anything about it, I'm afraid, because I haven't seen it. But very excited about that. I think she's a seriously brilliant composer.
Well, that very point that you haven't seen it, but you're performing it next month, leads us on to our other big point, which is differences between the UK. And I want to start out by, I wonder whether I can remind people at the beginning of the session, and Christiana said there's a lot more singing by rote. And I wonder how many of our listeners instantly had a, oh, well, that's obviously not as good as being able to read it quickly, because it's just a different mental skill. And it's a skill that, Sam, you remember when we had to learn the Monteverdi book four by heart. And Fagnini had done about 8 years of learning stuff by heart by then. But it's not normal to learn ensemble music by heart. And for us, at least with our background. And I think that leads to, you know, really top of the range readers like the BBC singers. They can sing something 1 week and possibly not even recognize it if it were put in front of them the next week. So it's a different sort of skill, but I do think it's an important one.
I'd just like to go, as someone who reads relatively quickly, I'd like to go into bat for people who don't read music. I think the speed at which we can do stuff, you know, the speed at which the English, let's say, choral tradition turns over repertoire and can you know, rehearse a 50-minute evensong in 15 minutes is obviously admirable and brilliant. But in lots of cases, I find it kind of the enemy of what actually the four of us would call good singing. It's not, you know, it's not embodied. It's not really committed. It's not, you're not fully imaginatively and physically in the act of delivering that, the meaning of that text. It's not not at all a criticism. It's just that the speed at which some of us can work isn't necessarily the same as being able to sing well at speed. Often it's the contrary.
I think there's really good things about all of it too. When I was at Selwyn singing evensong 3 or 4 times a week, my musicianship just accelerated so quickly. And I am so grateful for that experience, because I can read anything off the page now, because you had to, you know, you have 30 minutes to put a whole evensong together, maybe look ahead to something coming up the next week. Alternatively, we have these choirs here in the U.S. For example, at the University of Minnesota, we have a gospel choir of over 100 students, alumni, people in the community, all ages, all races, all backgrounds, and they use no sheet music, and they are fantastic. And like you said, the full-bodied singing, I think the expression learning by heart is such a beautiful one, because it is, it feels like it comes from the heart, and it's just embodied in such a beautiful way. And it's just all good. You know, I think we should celebrate all of it. And we've so often put one above the other, coming from a Western European-centric choral tradition. And one of the tenets of white supremacy, actually, is printed, notated, whether it's writing or music, whatever it is. And I think it's so wonderful that now we're starting to realize that there are more ways to do things.
One thing that really startled me when I started singing in professional choirs in England as opposed to America is the almost immediate homogeneity of the sound. I was really startled by how quickly everyone sang in exactly the same way. In American choirs, even professional choirs, where you turn over music fairly quickly, there is a sort of a period where you're really adjusting to each other's sound. Everybody's timbres are so different. And you're really learning how to sing together in a blended way while still allowing the personality of the voice to come through. And that takes a little bit of time. And the second thing I'll say is that I think there's really no substitution for rehearsal. I know that this is largely a financial consideration, which is completely understandable. But in the majority of cases, when I sing with professional choirs in the UK, there's very little rehearsal. You may have 1 or 2 rehearsals before you do the gig. And it's possible to do that because you have these singers who are marvelously trained. They can read anything off the page. But I do think the ensemble suffers a little bit because you haven't done that rehearsal time together, which isn't necessarily about note learning, but about shaping the phrase together and creating real specificity so that the experience is more exciting for the listener. If I may talk a little bit about my experience with Monteverdi Choir, one of the things that I think is so special about that choir is not necessarily that they have the best singers in the world or that the singers are wonderful. It's that John Elliott Gardner really likes to rehearse because he likes every phrase to be shaped in a very precise way. And he likes everything to be done just so. And he really won't let you get away with anything. And I think the result of that is you get this amazingly vibrant and specific performance that really makes the music leap off the page, particularly for the listener. And I think you sacrifice a little bit of that when you don't have, you know, more than two or three rehearsals. And speaking for myself, I don't sing the same way when I'm reading as when I really know the music. I'm more in my head. I'm more nervous. I'm holding my body in a tighter way. There's less freedom in the sound.
This relates us onto the business of money. Luthien, you've worked professionally in both countries. Actually, just looking at Christiane here, I was remembering something that her, I think, PhD supervisor, Sarah McDonald, was saying about, because she writes a column for, is it American Organists Review? One of the things she's having to tell them all is that the UK isn't this country that just turns out large, you know, where everyone is born with a silver sight reading spoon in their mouth and it just happens, because they're coming up to university now, not having done having had the school education that so many of their predecessors did. So let's try to get rid of that overgeneralization. But one issue in the professional world is fees. How is it, Luthien, the fee thing?
I would say that in general, the fees are much better in America. Now, this will vary regionally. But for example, if you are based in a city like New York or Boston or Los Angeles, you can feasibly make a career out of being a choral singer. And I did do it for a lot of years in New York City. It's not exactly apples to apples because, as I mentioned, you do a lot more rehearsing in America. You generally have five or six rehearsals in a professional ensemble in America before the performance, at least. And so it's not exactly directly comparable because, you know, you're getting a higher fee partly because you're rehearsing more. So you're using more time. But I would say that in general, the fees are much better in America.
You mentioned rehearsal time. Do you think there are things that American choirs do differently? Is it to do with speed of work, or is it just to do with the fact that they refuse to have less rehearsal?
Well, I would say that a lot of it has to do with doing, you know, professional choirs in America will still expect you to have learned the notes before you get to the first rehearsal. So it's not so much about learning, but it definitely is about ensemble. So I would say
that's a big difference. Straight away, that's a big difference. It's very unusual to be asked to do that, I think, in Britain. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I would say that's true. I mean, I think, I personally, coming from America, I always like to have the music in advance and I always like to look at it before the first rehearsal. I just feel less confident in my abilities compared with someone who's grown up in the UK tradition, having been potentially a chorister at a major cathedral and learning how to sight read from the time they were maybe 8 years old. So I always like to have that little bit of extra security. But yes, it is generally expected in America that you will have looked at the notes and generally know how the piece goes before you come to the first rehearsal. So I would say that in general, in professional choirs in the United States, most of the rehearsal time is taken developing ensemble, making the, doing the expressive gesture in the same way in the music.
Now, this relates to the sort of caricature of an English ex-cathedral type choir that specifically doesn't really interpret 16th century music. And, you know, one could write about that. But because 16th century music the surface of it is manageable on very little rehearsal because it's not terribly difficult to read. But let's also talk about programming, because that's interesting. In my limited exposure to American choirs and the sort of things they're doing, I do get the strong feeling that social issues are really strong up there.
Absolutely. And I think it's typical for choirs to program around a theme, and I often do with my community choir. So last spring we did a concert that was based on Libby Larson's Misa Gaia, Mass for the Earth. So it was all sort of about conservancy and caring for the earth and all music based around that theme. This year we're doing one that's called Peace on Earth, which is all about music from war-torn countries and celebrating the diversity among cultures, not only in our country, but globally. And I know just a lot of choirs sort of have this heart for advocacy, whether it's a current issue or something that represents their demographic. And I think, why not? You know, and a composer I really respect, Melissa Dunphy, who's based in the East Coast in the U.S., has said, I won't say it as well as she did, but something like, why do I want to write pretty whale music? You know, why do I want to write beautiful songs about flowers when I could be writing about gun violence or inequality? You know, and all of her music has some sort of mission, you know, to challenge people, to make you think. And I think that is something we do really well at. And I think part of that is we've got a lot going on that needs addressing, sadly.
It's something that is certainly a thing here, and you see it with promoters. I was talking to a promoter recently in a non-UK country, and they referred to the fig leaf of programming, where you need to make sure that you have something, which is not, it's just interesting because that was an aspect that they felt it in their slightly conservative programming circles, that it was a thing. I find singers of the younger generation are now absolutely committed to this. In different ways, of course, you can't cover all issues at once. But I do notice it a lot in things being suggested to me as a programmer myself, Dance Tower Music, but also just working with ex-singers from the University of York. It's really important to them. And if it's really important to that generation, that's where things are going to go.
Part of the issue of programming, and as you mentioned, these social justice sort of themes of music that's being performed now, considering Matthew Shepard springs to mind, a piece by Craig Hella Johnson, which is very popularly programmed in the United States right now, about the young gay man who was murdered. And I also, to your comment, Christiana, about, is it Melissa Dunphy? Mm-hmm. That piece reminds me of Sarah Kirkland Snyder's Mass for the Endangered, a piece that Gabriel Crouch's group Gallicantus recorded. I think a lot of it has to do with also the commissioning opportunities. And I know relatively little about the commissioning opportunities in the UK, but it seems to me that there are greater opportunities for commissioning in the United States. And also, commissioning opportunities that allow people to sort of, you know, choose what they want to highlight in their work and, you know, things that are important to them. So, for example, the Mass for the Endangered by Sarah Kirkland Snyder, that mass commissioning was part of a multi-mass commissioning project that was started at Trinity Wall Street. That was a choir that I sang in New York City. They are an unusual organization in that they are a large Anglican church. However, they also own a huge amount of real estate on the Isle of Manhattan. And so they have an extraordinary amount of money. They're a multi-billion dollar corporation as well as a church. And so the music program has an unusually large budget, and they use a lot of that money to do co-productions, for example, of operas like Angel's Bone by Du Yun, which also won the Pulitzer Prize. It's an opera on the theme of human trafficking. They did this mass commissioning project called Mass Reimaginings, of which Sarah's piece, Mass for the Endangered, was part. And so I think there are all kinds of these opportunities for commissioning new works that are available in the US that aren't necessarily available in the UK.
I mean, it so often comes back down to money, doesn't it? My very, very approximate sense of the difference between funding in the UK and the US is that, frankly, the US is just way better at private funding. There are tax breaks, and, you know, there's much more incentive for people to invest in the arts. Like you go to any town and it's got a fantastic modern concert hall named after the person who frankly paid for it. We don't quite have that infrastructure here. I think we're still, well, partly in the UK, we still think that classical music is a sort of a noble hobby. Partly we're used to some government money, so we're not used to having to find it ourselves. Robert, you'll be better placed than me, but it strikes me that the differences are really, really quite deeply ingrained.
And that is a suitable moment for us to mention that if people were to choose to listen to this podcast on Patreon, paying £3, £6, or £9 a month, that would be terribly helpful, because we are still keeping up our excellent record of having lost money on every single episode.
Consistency is our watchword, isn't it?
Exactly. So do please consider that. We're having to make some decisions about whether there's a future or not. So now would be a really good time to pop over to patreon.com and choose to listen to us on Crawl to Hour. Or frankly, just send us a large wad of cash in brown envelopes. That would be good. Robert Hollingworth, University of York. Not a word to anyone. That would be great. Last final thoughts before we hear our last track.
Well, that was such an interesting point you made about the funding, because we know that funding in the UK for the arts now is just, you know, disappearing quickly. And that is something that the US has always had to do because of a lack of government funding for the arts, is find it privately. So there are all these organizations that you can apply for grants for funding. So we've done that with our concerts before, is just applied for an arts grant from the Arts Council in Minnesota, which we received, and then we're able to hire musicians, or, you know, you could use that to commission a piece. So funding brings up an interesting point in the difference between our two countries, which I desperately hope that the UK, you know, finds ways to do that, to keep the tradition alive.
I think a big difference is that, of course, if you've done music at primary school, you're much more likely to be sympathetic towards choral music, opposed to no music's an extra that you do if you want as a choice. I mean, one of the things we're wondering about, and, you know, I'm happy to be as an individual quite open about this, is if we get a Labour government, I don't think there'll be any more money, but I do think there will be a change of priorities about music being valued as a subject. Whether it's too late after the extreme damage that's been done, you remember Tim Burnage's summary of this in the Thomas Leach episode about what is now the case. Sammy?
Well, it's my constant feeling is that it's very, very easy to destroy things and much, much harder to build them. And I think it's going to be, one hopes that priorities change and one hopes that the situation changes. But surveying what's happening, as you say, Christiana, at the moment around the UK at quite a fast rate is really very, very alarming, isn't it?
But remembering that we've been told to be positive in our episodes.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. It's the most devastating stuff that's ever happened. Is that positive enough?
Let's have some Bach. Is it Bach? Lucian, what are we going to finish? What are we going to hear? Because this is sensational.
So these are the wonderful Aeolians doing the Bach, the J.S. Bach motet, Singet dem Herrn.
I've got a thing about this. I wonder, you know, the way we have like dance music now and mosh pit music and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
What would, obviously you don't, but my youthful colleagues will know. I wonder in the 18th century what people really, really danced to, because this track that we're going to hear now is full of dancing, right? And Bach, we're always being told that Baroque music is dance music. One wonders if actually this is a totally, totally authentic way of replicating performance practice in some sort of slightly adjacent way.
I do wonder that as well. I think if I could have a time machine for one day, the thing I would want to do with it is go back in time to Leipzig, to when Bach was the director of music at the Thomaskirche, and hear what it actually sounded like when his choir performed one of his cantatas.
It would be amazing, wouldn't it? There's a story about Mendelssohn, who obviously revived all this stuff, going to Leipzig to research the Matthew Passion that he was putting on. And he was walking along the street in Leipzig, and his guide said, "Oh, that old man over there, who's just by the side of the road, he's 90 now, but he used to sing in the Thomanner Chor when Johann Sebastian Bach was running the choir." And Mendelssohn, of course, said, "I must go and talk to him." He got rushed over to speak to him and said, "You know, what did it sound like? You know, when you were singing Bach's music for Bach, what did it sound like?" And this sort of old man became very misty eyed and shook his head and said, "It sounded terrible."
Well, this is Peter Phillips, director of the Talis Scholars, point. It's quite possible, were we to go back to the 16th century, that we really wouldn't like what we heard. That doesn't stop us spending our lives trying to do justice to the music and to make it as good as it can, but it's always going to be our taste. Tom McKinney, Radio 3 producer, mentioning recently that if he could have had a time machine, he'd simply go back to when the last people in his flat put on this bloody awful wood chip paper and stop them doing it. so, thank you all for your time today. I'm quite sure this episode is going to involve an increasing post bag for us, you know, 9 or 10 emails with people telling us things about a completely different way singing in the US. We'll be glad to hear about from you. We'll be glad to hear from you if so. So this is the Aeolian Singers.
The Aeolians are a fabulous choir out of Oakwood University in America, which is a historically Black college and university. They're an entirely Black choir, and this is their marvelous, marvelous performance of J.S. Bach's Singet dem Herrn.
Christiana Howell, Luthien Brackett, and my colleague Lucas Murray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.